Today's guest will make you think twice before that next visit to Facebook or Amazon. Sure, they make life easier, letting you chat daily with your high school buddies or letting you order a new toaster with a single click. But at what cost to you? How much information about you, your tastes, your life is going out with those clicks and choices? Franklin Foer raises these questions in a sharp critique of Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple called World Without Mind, the Existential Threat of Big Tech. Franklin Foer edited the New Republic magazine for 7 years and is now a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation, a think tank dedicated to renewing America, politics and all, in the digital age. Franklin Foer, thanks for joining us today.
Happy fall.
Happy fall to you. There is no equivocation in your book at all. Big tech is an existential threat. That's what the subtitle says.
Yes. Well, so in the last 10 years, we've had the advent of all these incredible things. So my daughter just turned 12, and so she grew up in a world where when she was born, there was no iPhone, there was no Kindle, there was hardly such a thing as social media. And these inventions are pretty incredible. I think we can fairly say that they're real monuments to human creativity, and in some ways they've made our lives infinitely better. But there's also a magical quality to these inventions, and that magic can distract us from some of the darker parts of these technologies. And in my book, I'm trying to force us to reckon with some of those darker parts, namely that these technologies have also ushered in an age where we have these big companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and they exert enormous power over markets, they exert enormous power over our democracy. As you suggest, they've collected incredible amounts of data about us, that these troves of information, which are really this very, very intimate portrait of our psyche, they then in turn use to addict us to their products. And so I just think we need to reckon with what our dependence on these companies means for our future as a republic. And as we saw in this last election, all the questions that have trickled in over the last couple months about Facebook's role, that social media has played a role in weakening the foundations of our democracy by allowing fake news, conspiracy, emotionalism to spread by carving us into these filter bubbles where we hear what we want to hear. And we look at these things in aggregate, we're changing as human beings. And rather than just drifting into a future where we exceed control over our lives increasingly to these companies, I think it's important that we try to shape our future so that as we merge with machines, we try to preserve the institutions, the essence of our humanity, and that we make this transition in such a way that we preserve the things that deserve preserving.
Let's talk about the changing as human beings part, because your quote here is they'd like to mold humanity into their desired image of it. I mean, are the big four companies you list here trying to mold us, or are they just letting us mold ourselves as long as we're using their stuff?
I'm not sure there's much of a distinction between it, but what I argue in the book is that these are interesting companies because they're idealistic companies. They all that many of them have a vision for what the good life should become. So you take something like Facebook. Facebook has a vision of what constitutes a good human being. In Mark Zuckerberg's view, a good human being is a human being who shares information about themselves, who permits themselves to have an identity that they expose to the sunlight of common conversation, and that's something that would make us less hypocritical. We would cheat less on our girlfriends. We would present ourselves to the public in a way that was more authentic if people knew more about our lives. So that's very much a view of human good. If you listen to Google founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin, they have a view of human nature that involves us becoming cyborg. They want us to they believe that they can advance human evolution by completing this long merger between human beings and machines. So, Yes, these companies want to addict us in order to get our attention, in order to make money off of us. And we should never forget that fact about them. But we also, they say such profound things about human nature, which I find to be profoundly scary. And I think that we need to pay careful attention to those as well.
Franklin, you moved a little off microphone. If you can get it a little closer again, that'd be appreciated.
Yeah, sorry.
Other issue here, you point out you were not always thinking like this. And in fact, at one time you worked for Microsoft. What changed?
Right. So I worked for Microsoft when Microsoft started the online magazine Slate in the mid-1990s. And I've used all of these products in my own life and continue to use them in ways just because they exist and there's efficiencies to be had and there are useful things to be gotten off of them. But the thing that really started to change me most profoundly was that I became acutely aware of the power of these companies and how if you were on the other end, if you were producing things for them, the ways in which they could be bullying and they would be able to impose their values on you. And so the first flashpoint for me was I'm an author and I published books with a massive company called Hachette, which is a French company, and they got in a fight with Amazon over their ebook contracts. And Amazon just used a whole array of bullying tactics because Amazon controls such a vast part of the book business that they were able to prevent people from selling their books. And so that got me started thinking about just the grave dangers that these companies ultimately could pose to democracy.
Much more to talk about with Franklin Foer, and let's get a thought from you about whether you agree or not. I mean, do you use Facebook and yet cringe at the same time, thinking about its power? Same thing for Google, Amazon, Apple. These are all the four major companies targeted in Franklin Foer's book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. We'll come back on the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Franklin Foer and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Franklin Foer. He was the editor of the New Republic for 7 years, now national correspondent for The Atlantic, helped start Slate at Microsoft many years ago. He has some serious problems with Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, and singles them out for attention in a book talking about the dangers we face from monopolistic big tech companies. His book is called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your thoughts on the tech giants and how they influence or maybe even control our lives. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. There are a bunch of loops back in time that help us understand better how we got here. And the story does go back to Stuart Brand. What did he do, Franklin?
So one of the interesting accidents of our history is that we had the counterculture, the Grateful Dead, LSD, Ken Kesey and his merry band of pranksters happening at exactly the same place in the same time that the technology industry, the personal computer, the internet, was born. So just south of San Francisco on that peninsula, you had these two things rubbing up against one another. And so Stuart Brand was a guy who invented something called the Whole Earth Catalog. In the late 1960s and early 70s, lots of Americans flocked to join communes to try to disappear from society, to create these utopian villages where they would achieve some sort of new state of consciousness. They would get back to the land. And Stuart Brand created the Whole Earth Catalog to try to sell tools to these people who'd gone off to the communes and to try to create some sense of ideology for them. And so what he articulated in this Whole Earth Catalog, which it's really hard to overstate its importance to the counterculture and the amount of attention that it got at the time, what he tried to convince people was that in order to get a more holistic global consciousness, we needed tools. We needed to break free of technology, and technology would help us do that. And in the course of writing this catalog, he ended up coming up with concepts that were hugely important to Silicon Valley. Steve Jobs calls the Whole Earth Catalog his Bible. And Stuart Brand went on to come up with the idea of the personal computer. Not that people were developing the technology, but he came up with the term personal computer. He celebrated the earliest video games and compared them to LSD in the way that it would create this translate state. And so I bring this all up for one reason, which is to say that a lot of our ideas about technology are incredibly beautiful, and they come out of the counterculture, and there's a utopian spirit to a lot of them, especially this idea of the network, this idea that we can all be connected together, and that by virtue of our connection, we can achieve a new appreciation for one another and a new consciousness. And the problem with those beautiful ideas is that when they existed as hippie things, they could carry that kind of lyricism. But when they became captured by big firms, an idea like the network becomes the biggest business opportunity in human history. And rather than leading to this new state of global consciousness, what they've led to are monopolies, and the most powerful monopolies perhaps in human history.
You know, I find myself at this very moment thinking about George Carlin's old joke about being on the phone, being on hold. He said, wouldn't it be great if we could talk to each other while we were all on hold? Which is essentially what we've gotten to, except somebody's figured out a way to make this a business model. And as you point out, they crave monopoly, you say. They crave it.
Yeah, right. And so, I mean, the thing is to understand the path, it's so easy to understand the seductive powers of these companies because we feel their pull. We feel their pull every moment of the day. I mean, I shudder to think at the number of times that I check my cell phone over the course of the day. And I'm somebody who's just written a book about why this is terrible. But the magnetic pull of these platforms is such that we gravitate towards them even when we know we shouldn't. And we know that it's bad. And the question is, what's the real cost here? And in my book, I try to articulate a huge array of them. But really, for me, the fundamental thing is that they're just making us less independent thinking human beings. That the idea for me, my vision of the good life, and my vision of what makes us good citizens and what makes us human beings at core, is the capacity to contemplate, to think for ourselves, to make decisions that are thoughtful, to have moments of private reflection. And it's become harder and harder when you're constantly distracted, dinged, notified, when you feel this magnetic pull to this device where you subconsciously find yourself swiping and clicking, and it comes at a real cost. And I think that we can see this. We all have a very intuitive sense that we're losing something right now because of our addiction, because of the way that we've been swept up by these companies. And that's one of the reasons why I think this last election was important, was that for a lot of people, it was a wake-up call about what's happened to our culture and to our country. That you can see certain things happening in yourself, and then you can look out at kind of our collective and see that in some ways it's happened in a much more extreme version to a lot of people, where just the quality of information that they've gotten is diminished, and that they're stuck in the feedback loop that is Facebook, where they're getting exactly the information that they want to hear that confirms their biases, where they become susceptible to conspiracy, fake news, emotional, authoritarian sorts of appeals. And so what I'm challenging us to do is to look out at those people and to say, something similar is probably happening to us, and we just haven't fully recognized it.
Franklin Foer's book is World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. I've wondered a lot lately, actually, about this very point you're mentioning now, which is that people respond so quickly and so emotionally to what they perceive as outrages that their friends post on Facebook, for example, and yet they're responding on the very device that gives them access to most of the information known to humankind.
Right. So, again, I don't think we need to think about technology in this Manichaean sort of way, that the internet is a liberating phenomenon. It is an incredible invention. Phones are amazing devices, but we don't need to accept the way that they've been arranged for us, that we can try to make them better, and we can try to make ourselves better by shaping a better ecosystem in which we exist.
So let's talk about some of the specific companies you talk about here, the GAFA, as Europeans refer to them, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. You accuse Google of standing to transform life on the planet, but to what end? I mean, Google doesn't want us to stop thinking, does it?
No, but I think what Google wants us to do is to be absorbed into machines. They want us to merge with machines. Sergey Brin, who's one of the co-founders of Google, talks about a fantasy of having Google implanted within our brain. And they're very committed to, all these companies are committed to ideas about artificial intelligence, but I think that they view artificial intelligence as this emancipatory development where by merging with the machine and by merging our brain with the brain of the machine, it's going to free us up for spectacular things, for almost a messianic vision of a life to come. What's problematic about that? Well, what's problematic about it is that a company that's amassed that kind of power, that views itself on that kind of theological mission, it means that they just, if whatever they trample, whatever cost it takes to arrive at that utopia, they're just not very concerned. And so when they've gone through and they've transformed a lot about our lives without really considering the ethical or moral or civilizational costs of what they've done.
There's a few names I didn't expect to find in a book about Google and Facebook. Rene Descartes, and you said that Google is following his footsteps. In what sense?
So there's this great dream in Western thinking that you can liberate the mind from the body. And so if the mind is our software and the body is our hardware, and in a lot of Western thinking since the Enlightenment, the mind is the place where you can see the divine, and the body is the flesh. It's the thing that decays. It's the site of sin. And so what Google wants to do by pursuing its vision of artificial intelligence is that, and this is not everybody at Google. I think this describes maybe Larry Page, the founder, and Ray Kurzweil, who's the director of engineering, is that at some point our minds are going to get uploaded into the cloud or onto the internet or into computers, and our minds are going to be able to live forever once we shed our imperfect bodies. And so that's the vision really at the core.
We are talking to Franklin Foer, who is a national correspondent for The Atlantic, formerly with Slate and editor of The New Republic for 7 years. His book is called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. He takes a major whacking stick to Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon in the book. Let's get your thoughts about the world in which we inhabit now and how these companies are influencing your lives and making it easier. Are they taking something in return in addition to your money from time to time? 800-838-3760 by phone to join the conversation. You can join by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So let's turn now to Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. He wants a robust public square. You say it's not that. What is it then instead?
Well, one of the things about, I'm sure most of your users are probably familiar with Facebook's newsfeed. And so Facebook's newsfeed is where you see what your friends have posted and shared. And it's hard to tell that there's anybody in control of that system. It gives the illusion that you're in control of the news and information that you're getting. But really, just like television, that news and information is being programmed, because Facebook has algorithms, which are procedures that it uses to sort that news and information to make it maximally addictive for you so that you spend the most time on their site. And so they provide hierarchy to the news and information. And the there are a couple problems with that. One is that this is done on the basis of all of that data that it's collected about you. And so it's giving you the news and information that you want. And so the news and information you want may not necessarily be the news and information that you need. It's oftentimes highly emotional. It plays on our anxieties, and it ideologically confirms our biases. The second problem is that journalism also depends on Facebook, that to get the revenue that journalism needs, it needs traffic, and that traffic can only come via spreading journalism on Facebook. And so the values of Facebook end up getting internalized by all of the media companies that are dependent on Facebook. And I saw this when I was at the New Republic. I saw the ways in which chasing traffic on Facebook just, it distorts who you are. You begin to play the same games that Facebook is saying it plays with the sensational headlines. You try to write about the topics that you know are popular on Facebook rather than the topics that you think are most worthwhile to cover. And it's just led to this degradation of the public square.
Well, it's interesting. When you put it this way, I realize that it can still be a public square, but it's a public square with screens in which we only get to see our own corner of that square and not everybody else in it. Again, our guest is Franklin Foer. He's the editor, or the author, rather, of World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. It seems a little hard of late to keep up with stories of people using Facebook for potentially nefarious purposes. And just yesterday, for example, I noticed Facebook agreed to give Congress the 3,000 political ads bought from Russian accounts. I mean, this manipulation doesn't seem to surprise you much at all.
No, it doesn't, because the problem with Facebook as a system is that Facebook cares about one thing, which is keeping users active. There's a concept that we used in journalism, which is the concept of the gatekeeper, so that there's somebody who's making a decision always about what's the most important information. And once upon a time, when there were newspapers and television networks and radio networks that were the most important players in media, the people who ran those networks and newspapers made those decisions about what was most important, what wasn't important, what would go at the front page or the front of the broadcast, and what wouldn't get covered. And that's a lot of power to have in a democracy. And there were a set of rules that the people who were gatekeepers played by. And you could argue with the rules, and you could certainly argue with the moral judgments made by those gatekeepers who often cozied up to power or play down things that the stories that were against their own self-interest, but at least they were making judgments and they had some sense of obligation towards their readers and listeners, towards their audience, and also they developed rules about their own power. So we have concepts like objectivity, which were important in that old system, that when you tried to present information, It needed to strive towards a measure of truthfulness. Now, Facebook and Google as gatekeepers don't claim any responsibility. They just claim to be giving people what they want. And so that means that if you were the Russian government trying to manipulate the election, well, they were just giving those people what they wanted as advertisers. If you're an anti-Semite trying to reach other anti-Semites, well, then no problem. Facebook is just going to empower you to do whatever you want. And the problem is that they created a system that's essentially amoral, where everything is commodified. And then when it comes time for somebody to take responsibility for the results of the terrible things that have happened, there's nobody there to take responsibility for it.
Now, I was actually writing the term what they want as you said it, because this is something that really resonates with me, but it actually predates algorithms. Algorithms may be doing the work now, but a lot of organizations have done this for a long time with all kinds of products, focus group testing and polling and surveying to see what people like and then giving them more of what they like.
Well, that's a fair point. And it's true that part of capitalism is that, part of capitalism, the whole idea of the market is that you give people what they want. Part of advertising and part of the market is that sometimes there's a bit of manipulation involved there, where you're creating wants and needs and desires in order to sell whatever new product you've created. But there are a couple differences here in this new system that I think makes what's happening more dangerous. Namely, it's data. It's that these guys have they've surveilled the hell out of you. They know where you've been. They know what you've read. They know what you've bought, and they leverage that portrait in order to manipulate you. And so you're not really getting what you want. You're being manipulated based on this incredibly intimate portrait of you to get what they think you want.
Franklin Foer talks more about Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple and his issues with them in his book, World Without End, The Existential Threat of Big Tech, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Franklin Foer, who is essentially blowing our mind with the ways in which four big tech companies are making use of the information that we voluntarily give them. He's talking about Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon in his book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Franklin Foer is now a national correspondent for The Atlantic, previously editor of The New Republic for 7 years, and also helped start Slate at Microsoft. So he's had some exposure on several ends of this. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to finish up with Facebook. You mentioned that Facebook has boasted about its ability to shape democracy. I hadn't heard that.
Right. So this is one of those experiments that they conducted that seems really benevolent or possibly innocuous, but that once you dig into it, it begins to take on a different sort of cast, which is that Facebook claimed that it could increase voter turnout by highlighting the fact that you'd voted. So in order, it created a system where you put kind of social pressure on your friends because they'd be more likely to vote if they saw that all the rest of their friends had voted. So voting is cool. We're going to make it cool. We're going to try to create a new norm where voting becomes a norm. And so they ran this as a small experiment, and they showed that by highlighting people's voting patterns in their newsfeed, they were able to increase voter turnout by a fraction of a percent. So this seems like a pretty big deal, because if Facebook decided that they wanted to replicate this on a big scale, they could turn it on and off for people without anybody really knowing, because we don't know how their algorithms work. And so if Mark Zuckerberg wanted to run for president, for instance, which is an idea that maybe 6 months ago, a year ago, seemed outside the realm of discussion, but now is considered perfectly plausible. So if Zuckerberg wanted to run for president, he knows essentially the type of people who would be likely to vote for him, because Facebook knows your political preferences. They know they know your polling precinct. They know your religious beliefs. They know your ideological preferences. And so if they wanted to turn on a voter turnout machine to gin up support in places that would be most helpful for Mark Zuckerberg, they could do that and nobody would know who was appealed to and who wasn't appealed to. And so do I think that this scenario is likely? Not particularly, but I pointed out to highlight the power that they have. And also, we just need to dig back into American political history to see the ways in which media companies have behind the scenes worked to affect the outcomes of elections. So it may not be likely, it may be a little bit conspiratorial, but it's the type of thing that we have to consider as we allow these companies to amass their power.
I want to get another quote of yours from within the book. A wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. Actually, I don't think it's your quote necessarily, but even though we have all this available to us out there in the world today from Facebook, all the things we can find out from Google, instead of actually being smarter, we're being dumber.
Right. So what I'm saying is that it's become so hard to get people to pay attention to anything. It's hard to get them to pay attention to big problems like global warming or racial injustice in this country. It's hard to get them, if you write an article, it's hard to get people to pay attention to that article because we live in a world of informational clutter. There's just, we've never, when you have access to every book that's ever been written on a device, that you can download it in an instant, when you can use Google to search for the most esoteric information and gets returned to you within milliseconds, we live in a world where we've never been more just awash in information. So what becomes so important in this world are the people who have the capacity to organize that information in a way that's useful for you. And if you're interacting with that world of information essentially through a small handful of platforms, the power of those platforms is just immense.
And so so I can see where the potential issue rises here, where that if you think you're getting all the information there is in the world, but managed and curated nicely for you, the fact is you're really not finding out about things that you don't already know about in some cases.
Right, and it's a sense that you as an individual have more capacity to know the world than you've ever had before. It creates a sense that why do we need experts? If I'm able to find out about climate change myself by doing a couple of Google searches, then why bother with some guy in a think tank or some researcher in a university? So it erodes the authority of the people in charge. And if you look at Facebook, there's something similar that happens where everything in Facebook is about the headline. The source of the information is much, much less important. And I think people pay much less attention to the actual source of the information. They click on the basis of the headline. I think that's the way that Facebook has designed things. But part of what we used to have and what's diminished is this sense of authority. And, you know, I think that a lot of us are probably by temperament or by cultural training, we look at authority with a measure of distrust. But the reason that authority matters is that society can only function if we have facts, if there are certain things that we can agree to be true. So we're never going to get a climate policy in this country if we can't all agree about certain basic facts. Same is true about our healthcare system or about racial justice. And you need, in order for people to agree in facts, we need to believe that there's some sources capable of generating unimpeachable or barely impeachable facts. And we just don't have that right now. And I'm afraid that what's happened with Facebook and Google is that they've destroyed the authority of facts by this new world that they're creating. And for democracy, it's going to be really hard for us to regroup and come up with some sort of system that helps us interpret the world in some sort of way that allows for a shared common sense of reality.
Let's take a call here. I want to bring in James in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Franklin Foer. His book is World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Hi, James.
Good morning, Jeffrey and Franklin. This is a fascinating conversation. And believe it or not, I just downloaded your book from Audible in about 2 seconds. So,
thank you so much.
It's going to listen
a miracle.
Sale.
But speaking of, you know, I feel as though I'm an information technology manager, and I work for the Forest Service, have for 40 years. I've seen a lot of tech change, and I'm working on the virtual business environment right now. So I'm thinking a lot about artificial intelligence, and I've heard recently that the three greatest threats to humankind are artificial intelligence, nuclear war, and climate change, and not necessarily in that order.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've mentioned climate change a number of times. It's that focus of attention on information that builds the capacity of a company's desire to have you hooked into their system that is so much a human thing, right? So I think I'm curious what your thoughts are about how I and we can extract ourselves out of the system enough to be able to have our own discernment and have our own intelligence that can guide us through our lives. And I do that through meditation, but I'm wondering if you could give me some guidance on, it looks like Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, that changed my life. And,
yeah.
You know, I've given thousands of presentations on climate change now. That movie, what it didn't do very well was it didn't describe what we can really do.
All right, so the call to action then is what we're looking for here.
Yeah, call for action.
Thanks for that, James. Appreciate it. In fact, the whole section three of the book is Take Back the Mind. So what are some baby steps here,
right.
Franklin?
Well, so meditation actually I think would be in the realm of one of the areas that I would suggest that we try to inhabit, which is we need to find modes of disconnection, that we need to find the seams in the system where we can exist. And the idea of reclaiming truly private space where we can contemplate the world, I think is necessary for us as individuals, that we need to, and I use this word in almost a non-religious context, but it's a word with religious connotations, which is that we need to tend to our souls, and that this process of merging with machines is one that's almost unavoidable, but in order to avoid the worst implications of it, we really do need to constantly remind ourselves that we're human beings capable of agency, capable of who need to have moments of private thought where we're in control over over the subjects that we're considering and who considers them on our own, where we process everything. So that's one area. The second area is that I think that we need to, so there's a metaphor in my book, which is with food. So that 50 years ago, we had the advent of processed foods, TV dinners, and the like, and then we woke up 50 years later and we realized, holy cow, these foods were engineered to make us fat, and they completely remade the whole method of producing food. And that's a pretty grim analogy, because I'm arguing that the same thing that happened with the things we ingest through our mouths is now happening with the stuff that we ingest through our minds, where it's being reverse engineered to addict us, and the whole economy of producing knowledge has been scrambled to become much, much more concentrated. But there's a hopeful part to that analogy, too, which is that at least some portion of the population awoke to the dangers, and they started to self-correct. They started to think about organic food. They started to care about what they put in their mouths. They started to make certain sacrifices where they said, you know what? Efficiency isn't the only good. We're going to shop at farmers markets. We're going to try to support producers that we like, because we think that it's more virtuous for them, more virtuous for our planet, more virtuous for ourselves. And so we could do the same thing with knowledge and culture, and that will require us to a certain extent to become Medicis, to become patrons in the same sort of way that we become patrons for farmers, where we support the public radio stations that we listen to, where we buy subscriptions to the newspapers that we feel are essential to our own education and self-improvement, but also to the democracy. And I think we need to also put political pressure on these companies and pressure on our leaders. Right now, Mark Zuckerberg has been exposed in the last couple of weeks for Facebook's role in abetting Russian propaganda. And we know Facebook is guilty of a whole variety of sins. What would be great is if Mark Zuckerberg actually had to testify before the Senate and answer for questions. I think that would do a whole lot to shake some of the mystique here. I mean, that's a very small bore thing, but it's a necessary step as we start to build towards the sort of revival of antitrust that we need, as we build to the creation of real data protection laws in this country. But one thing that's just blows my mind is that we don't have a single law in this country protecting our data. I mean, it's absurd.
As you point out, that the Data Protection Authority would be a good idea, but I mean, this is a Congress that doesn't even particularly want to regulate banks very much right now. They want to undo the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right, right. So, I mean, it's not a hopeful time for any sort of instructive legislation appearing, but these things take time. You need to have the good ideas sitting there on the shelf for the time that the next crisis happens, when for whatever reason Congress feels moved to break free from its slumber and selfishness and feels inclined to do something for the good.
Well, you certainly got us thinking in this book. It's called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Franklin Foer, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
All right, take care.